This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The fluctuating stock market has been taking investors on a wild ride, and the number of Americans with queasy stomachs is much higher than it would have been even a decade ago. In 1990, only 23% of adult Americans owned stock or mutual funds. By the end of the decade, the figure had doubled. My guest, Daniel Gross, no relation, is the author of the new book Bull Run, about Wall Street and the new politics of personal finance. He's a journalist who has written about business and politics for The Washington Post, The New Republic, and Investment News. I spoke with him yesterday, which was the sixth worst day in the history of the NASDAQ, the composite index of technology stocks. It was down 25% from the height it had reached March 10th. In a recent New York Times op-ed piece, Gross wrote that the wild fluctuations in the market doesn't mean the bull market is over, but the bull run might have ended for companies using the internet to deliver goods, services, or content. I asked what led him to that conclusion.
A lot of the individual stocks, especially individual internet stocks, companies that came public, say they came public at 10 or 15, and in their first week there was such demand that they flew up to 50, 60, 70, a lot of those stocks are now back in the single digits. So there have been near catastrophic losses in some of these companies. Companies like DrCoop.com, which is now trading at about 3. CDNow, which sells compact discs over the internet, also at around 3. Online grocers like Peapod, also down to about 3 or 4. And when a stock gets in that level, it really inhibits the ability to either sell more stock to the public or to make an acquisition using that stock, which has been the traditional means of growth and expansion for internet companies.
Do you think that investors are becoming more skeptical of companies that haven't shown profits?
Certainly. If there's anything that the action in the last few months, and it's not the last week, it's the last 3 or 4 months, it's that the gospel that, you know, you had to spend money to make money, and the rationale, the reason for being of a lot of these internet companies was, we're going to raise a lot of money from the public, plow it into marketing and advertising, and therefore losses in the short term are acceptable because we're building a brand, we're establishing a presence. The market bought into that for a couple years. In the last few months, however, as companies have begun running low on cash, as they've become more desperate for new capital, and as they have failed to show results from a lot of this spending, institutional investors like mutual funds have really soured on the whole sector, and the individual investors who provided so much of the trading activity in these stocks have also left and gone on to the new thing, which is, you know, business-to-business internet companies.
What are business-to-business internet companies?
As opposed, the first internet companies that came public, the Amazon.coms, America Onlines, these are business-to-consumer, B2C. They are businesses that are selling products or services to consumers. It's obviously an expensive proposition because you're shipping one book at a time. You have to spend a lot on kind of mass marketing. The new thing has been business-to-business companies, companies that sell their products and services to other businesses. That is now thought to be more profitable, more viable in the long term than many of these business-to-consumer companies.
What do you think the wild fluctuations in the stock market in the past couple of weeks have to say about the new high-tech stocks versus the old economy stocks? I mean, for such a long time, people were saying, oh, the old economy is dead. It's all the vitality is in the new economy, the high-tech stocks. And that seems to be reversing a little bit in the past couple of weeks.
I think what it shows, and this is part of the democratization of money, is the ease with which people can move money around. Transaction costs for trading stocks or trading money in and out of mutual funds are very low, and people have the ability to log on to their brokerage site or their bank and move money around very quickly, very easily. You don't have to call a broker anymore to do it. And when you see when the NASDAQ goes up 20%, then down 20%, and the people on television are talking about money moving into different sectors. You know, today it's moving into the pharmaceuticals. Tomorrow it's moving into paper companies. What this shows is the great ability of individuals and institutions to move money in and out of sectors, markets, individual stocks very quickly and very cheaply. People are not taking their money out of the market and putting it in an interest-bearing checking account or under their mattress as they did, you know, back in the 1930s. People have a lot of faith in the stock market as an entity. What you're seeing is more a change of fortunes of different sectors relative to one another.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Gross. He's the author of the new book, Bull Run, Wall Street, the Democrats, and the New Politics of Personal Finance. Your new book is about what you describe as the democratization of money. Would you explain that expression for us?
Sure. It has two meanings. The first is democratization with a small d, and I think everybody is aware of these manifestations. What I'm talking about is the vast expansion of the shareholding population, the explosion of the financial media, the ability to trade stocks on the internet, the notion of the markets as a shared public space that are accessible not only to the rich, but also to the middle class. And so that's the democratization of money or the markets with a small d. This has been accompanied by the democratization of the markets with a big D, by which I mean that the Democratic Party, historically an antagonist towards Wall Street and the markets, has in the 1990s come to love and embrace the markets. And in return, the markets and Wall Street have come to love and embrace the Democratic Party, in particular the Clinton administration.
What are some of the things that changed in the 90s pertaining to who invests and how they invest that you think changed the shape of Wall Street?
In the 90s, there has been a vast explosion in the sheer size of the investing public. In 1990, about 23% of American households had mutual funds. Today, it's probably close to half. And the interest in stock markets has grown at every income level. The very wealthy, the upper middle class, obviously not so much in the working classes or lower income levels. But the interest at every level in investing in the market has grown because people are pursuing their retirement. They are increasingly empowered to control their own financial destiny. In other words, it used to be you went to work for a company. They set up the pension for you. They made the donations. They decided where the money went. Now, with increased mobility, the growth of 401ks, individuals are not only being asked to, but they're in many cases being forced to make those decisions about what is done with their retirement money. So that has been a main factor.
By the way, you know, in talking about how people have money tied up in the market through their retirement funds, and have become more interested in the market as a result of that. Your father is a good example of that. Tell us about your father.
Well, I use the example of my parents. My father was a English professor at Michigan State University. He began working there in 1966. And as was probably typical of people of his generation and profession, had comparatively little interest in what was going on in the stock market. Every year, however, he and Michigan State University made contributions to TIAA-CREF. And over the last 34 years, those small contributions, which were taken out of a modest salary, ballooned in size to the point where I believe, you know, my parents woke up one day in the mid-90s and realized they were substantial stockholders. And this is a process that has repeated itself countless times. At TIAA-CREF, some 32,000 of their members have assets over $1 million, and 120,000 have assets over $500,000 in the pension fund alone. So these are a lot of social scientists out there who have gotten rather wealthy off the 90s bull market.
My guest is Daniel Gross. His new book is called Bull Run, Wall Street, the Democrats, and the New Politics of Personal Finance. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Daniel Gross. He writes about Wall Street and personal finance. He has a new book called Bull Run, Wall Street, the Democrats, and the New Politics of Personal Finance. Let's talk about how changes in Wall Street have affected politics. Now that Wall Street is of interest to so many more people are invested in the market, how is that affecting politics?
In the 80s, there was a very stark divide. Wall Street equals wealth equals Reagan Republicans, and Democrats were arrayed against that alliance. And what you've seen in the 90s, and it's been a slow but steady transformation with every passing year, that the Clinton administration has become more invested, not only probably personally, but politically in the markets. And as the markets have expanded, as they became more accessible, as they became more populous, it made more sense for a Democratic president to embrace them, to want them to do well. Not just because he was in office, but because the retirement funds of so many people and so many Democratic constituents, labor unions, teachers, college professors, because so much of their money is in the market, it behooves a Democrat as much as it does a Republican to worry about the health and stability of the markets.
How has the new alliance between Wall Street and the Democrats affected the Republican Party?
I think it's affected them negatively. Historically, the Republicans were the party aligned with Wall Street. And as the Democratic Party has become more moderate, perhaps more conservative, more aligned with Wall Street in its worldview and outlook, the Republican Party, over the course of the 90s, has gone in the opposite direction. With each passing election, the congressional Republicans have become more populist, more Southern, more skeptical of issues like free trade, the global financial architecture, the notion of businesses being in business to make a profit versus moral concerns. And so you've seen that there's been a disconnect, both politically and culturally, between the congressional leadership and Wall Street. It used to be that a lot of the, what we used to call the Rockefeller Republicans, who were primarily Northeastern and socially moderate, who became involved in politics, were cut from the same cloth as the people who ran Wall Street firms. They went to the same prep schools, the same Ivy League universities. Now it's the Democrats who are more from that cloth, and the Republicans, people like Trent Lott, Dick Armey, these are people who want nothing to do with the East Coast establishment and who have very little in common culturally or socially or politically with the wealthy people who run Wall Street firms today.
What are some of the things that you think the Clinton administration did that were most pleasing to investors?
Part of it was a mindset. In the early year, in 1993, there were these sort of epic internal battles between the left advisors, people like Paul Begala and George Stephanopoulos. And, you know, this has all been documented very well in various memoirs. The battle was between the left and the kind of more moderate Wall Street-oriented advisors like Robert Rubin as to how the administration should approach Wall Street and the budget deficit and Alan Greenspan and the prerogatives of the bond market. And the outcome was that in 1993, Clinton proposed a budget that began to reduce the deficit. And this was over the objections of many people in the more liberal wing in the White House. That sent a message early on that the Clinton administration was very interested in what Wall Street and the public markets thought about their policies. And that mindset came to dominate more and more as the years went by. In addition, there's nothing Wall Street hates more than instability. And there have been various periods, the Mexico crisis of late 94, early 95, the Asian crises and Russian crises of 97 and 98. And these were instances in which members of the Clinton administration really took the lead in working with the IMF and the World Bank to orchestrate these bailouts of first Mexico and then the Asian countries and Russia. At the same time the Clinton administration was working to do this, you had the Republicans in Congress who were actively seeking to undermine that. And whatever the merits of any of those bailout programs were, they seemed to work in that they restored stability. So the Clinton administration, because people like Robert Rubin, who had been the chairman of Goldman Sachs and was the Treasury Secretary for many years, because of his worldview and his interest in understanding what Wall Street needed and wanted, the administration took actions to help restore stability to the markets time and again.
Do you think the phenomenon that you describe as the democratization of money might really change if the stock market has a serious fall, that people might feel burned and that the trend we saw in the 90s might reverse itself?
Well, for that to happen, there would have to be a truly serious fall. I mean, if you go back to 1992, the Dow is up about 3.5 times, and the NASDAQ is still up at least 5 times. So in order for people to feel as if they, as long-term investors, have lost money, we would really have to have a catastrophic fall. The other thing is that I think people have been so conditioned by the financial media that you buy and you hold for the long term. And so many of today's investors, especially those who are investing in pension funds, are simply having a certain amount deducted from their paycheck every week or every month. So it's not as if there were a severe pullback, I don't think everybody or a large part of the population would simply stop investing. Most people have longer time horizons. And in addition, as we've seen, and it happens very quickly, that when one sector or area falls out of favor, money quickly moves to other sectors, and Wall Street still benefits from that. In other words, if U.S. stocks were seen as poor performers, people would start investing in European stocks or Asian stocks, or they would buy mutual funds that specialize in bonds. Either way, people would still be invested, they would still be trading, and they would still be watching what happens in the market. So I don't think that it is likely to kind of disappear as a force or even subside, even if there is a substantial correction.
A lot more people are invested in the stock market than ever before, but there's still a very large percentage of the American public that is not. What about them?
That remains one of the challenges. And as with everything else that makes American lives better, whether it's home ownership or health insurance, the lower income people of this country have not participated in the bull market to the extent that the wealthier have. Now, a fair number of working class people, people who are members of unions or people who are civil servants or teachers or janitors, they have been participating through their pension funds. They may not have brokerage accounts, but they are all invested because money is being invested on their behalf by these very large institutions. That said, there's a very large part of the population that is not invested in the market. And there have been proposals, government proposals, in fact, to change that, namely the whole idea of investing Social Security funds in the market. If that were actually to happen, then anybody who has worked on the books would become a shareholder to a very small degree. And of course, you know, I think that's in some ways, a very dangerous proposal and obviously a very controversial one and one that I think a lot of people on the left oppose. But in some senses, that would represent the ultimate in the democratization of money because it would instantly expand the shareholder population to include all kinds of people who had not been included before.
Well, sure, everybody would be included on it, but everybody would be vulnerable in a way that they hadn't before because, you know, your retirement money would be completely tied to the market. So if something bad happened, then
well,
what?
I think even the most aggressive proposals call for only a portion of the funds or a small portion of the total funds to be invested in the stock market. So you wouldn't necessarily have the prospect of people being wiped out. I'm just saying that it's ironic that something that the proposal that would help kind of socialize ownership of American companies greater is one that started off life as came from the fringes of the right wing and has become pretty mainstream in a matter of a few years. And that's another sign of the this notion that the markets are a almost, you know, friendly, almost benign force in our society. In the 80s, if anybody stood up and said, let's put Social Security funds in the stock market, I think they would have disappeared from view rather quickly.
Daniel Gross, have you been investing in the market for a long time?
About 4 years.
That's not that long.
If I was more successful at investing, I wouldn't be writing books.
Right. Okay, fair enough. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Daniel Gross is the author of the new book, Bull Run, Wall Street, the Democrats, and the New Politics of Personal Finance. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.